Good afternoon, Representative DeShane and members of the committee. My name is Lee Cantor. I work as the state's moose biologist. And I think I'll generally run through the report, giving you some overview in the highlight section here and go into some details a little bit here and there. I think the first thing to start with is to talk a little bit about the type of management activities, management actions that we do in order to figure out how the moose are doing out there on the landscape. And so I'll start by saying we do two different types of helicopter survey work. We've been doing this for 7 years now. Just completed another mission on Monday. And these surveys are two different types. One is to run transect lines on a particular management area to get an idea of moose abundance. And then the other type of survey we do, which is a separate helicopter flight, is to get in the helicopter and actually sex and age moose based on whether they're bulls, cows, or calves by management district. We do this mostly in the northern part of the state. Some of those surveys can't be done in the more mountainous areas in western Maine because you can't fly a helicopter 200 feet above ground in the Rangeley Mountains because of for obvious reasons. But we've been doing this for 7 years. It's really brought the moose management into kind of a new era, I would say. It's a nice capability. We work with our partners over there at the Maine Forest Service and their ranger pilots to conduct this work, and just to say that we couldn't do it without those guys. They keep us safe, and it's an impressive thing. We can only fly in wind speeds below 10 miles per hour on days with no precipitation. And how many days are like that in northern Piscataquis and in Arista counties? Not a lot, so it's full bore. So that's a real big driver for how we gather information on moose. Secondly, of course, we have a lot of information that comes out of the actual moose hunt itself. And so at the moose check stations, of course, when somebody tags a moose, we get information, especially on characteristics of bulls, looking at antler spread. Many of the stations give us weights. And, of course, as some of you know, at a lot of these, we get teeth that give us an idea of specific ages of moose. But from a biologist standpoint, it's a rich data source because it gives us age distributions of bulls. We can get age distributions of cows. And it's a really valuable piece of data. And Maine is probably unique among states that we probably get about 90% of these animals harvested. We get the teeth from, and we're able to do that in-house and get the actual ages and give that back to Maine moose hunters so they know the specific age of their animal. And as you can imagine, many successful moose hunters really like to know those kind of stats on their moose. The other thing is we have we've had a late season hunt for a number of years, which is primarily a cow hunt. We've been able to have this late hunt since for a number of years.
Is it Bonnie?
Bonnie's going to have to pay
my bill.
The first one's free.
So we have a late season hunt we've held for a while. On antlerless moose, mostly cows, a few calves are taken. I want to just state, as in the past, is that these hunts take place because in many of those management districts, moose have been above the density that has been set by the public. So there's been too many moose. And if you have too many moose, one of the ways to try to affect change is to have a cow harvest. Now, a side part of that is that when we do that in a late season, for two reasons. One is because if you're going to have a cow harvest, you want to do it as late as possible so that any cows that have calves maintain that bond as late as the season as possible, so you wouldn't do it during September. The other part of that is it gives us an ability to collect data on reproduction, which is the ovaries of the moose. And if I was to say to you, if there's one piece of data that I could have to manage moose in the state that tells us a lot about the health of a population, it'd be able to look at the ovaries and some of the structures within those. So that's another element. Another element we get from the moose hunt is that by statute, all moose hunters are required to fill out a hunter survey card. We don't get the kind of returns that we need to have. And again, moose hunters are required to do this. We probably get about a 30% return rate. So you go on your moose hunt. You hunt Monday through Wednesday. You get your moose on Wednesday. You send a little card back to us that says, I hunted for, 20 some odd hours. I saw 3 bulls, 2 cows, 1 calf, some grouse, and a couple of deer. That information comes back to our shop, and we come up with moose hunter sighting rates, which is another element of how we manage moose. In 2016, our last harvest looks like it was very successful. The last 2 years have been pretty successful. And when I say that, what I'm saying is the September hunt is probably in the 80% plus success rate. The October season has dropped to about 70%. And this year, our late season cow hunt, which was the second season in October, was actually up to in the 80 percentiles. I'm just looking at this information now. But I tell you that because a lot of what's happened in the last 5-plus years has been very much related to weather. So we've had fall hunts in October where in Caribou it's been 70 degrees. And it tends to be the moose are out there, but not only does a moose like to be in a little bit more shade sometimes, but the moose hunter, may not be as active on a day where you wake up expecting it to be 40 degrees and be a moose hunt in the fall. And when it's hitting 70 degrees, it gets a little ugly. So we're working on the data right now. What happens in the next few weeks is that we churn out a bunch of summary data, analysis of things like moose hunter sighting surveys. We do these aerial surveys literally up as to the last bit of time we have until we get together with all the regional wildlife biologists throughout the state from Gray to Ashland and put together our permit recommendations for the advisory council. And so that happens this year. It's going to happen around mid-February, and step one of our rule-making process will begin, I believe it's the third week of February. So there's a short turnaround time for churning out that data. A couple of other things I have in the report is that for the 8th year, we've had a controlled so-called controlled moose hunt in eastern Arista County. This has primarily been a hunt of a few animals. Lately, it's been 25 moose, and primarily in the broccoli fields. Now, the broccoli crop in eastern Arista County is a very important crop. It changes locations annually because of rotation of fields. And as you can quite imagine, moose can raise a lot of havoc when they enter a broccoli field. And so there's some issues there with, obviously, food for human consumption and moose, et cetera. And we've worked really closely with some local folks and sportsmen, our warden service and biologists to come up with a pretty good product that's morphed over the years. Currently, it's operated as a disabled vets hunt, and we work closely with the Veterans Administration up in Caribou to get disabled vets out there to take those moose. And we have a local outfitter, Dave Hintosh, who does this for no charge, who does just a fantastic, it's an unbelievable thing he does. So that's continued, and we'll be making recommendations to continue that this year, 2017, for the 9th season. And lastly, to bring you up to date, in 2014, our department started a research project to assess adult cow and calf survival. This became more important over time because, as many of you know, and we've had this highlighted in the media quite frequently over the years, is that we have a little insidious parasite out there called the winter tick. And the winter tick, real briefly, is its own species. It's not a dog tick. It's not a deer tick. It's the winter tick. And I've noticed that a lot of folks that I come in contact with think a winter tick is like a colloquial name for a tick that's around in the winter, but it's not. It's its own species. And the thing that's insidious about a winter tick is that unlike all of our other ticks, it's a one-host tick. So it spends its 3 life cycles, larvae, nymph, and adult, on one critter. And in this case, it gets on other critters besides moose, but it likes moose because moose are essentially defenseless when ticks get on them, which is in October, November. So, and the other thing about the winter tick is that unlike other ticks, when mama tick lays her eggs, she does 1,000 to 3,000 in one spot. When those eggs hatch at the end of summer into fall, all those little larvae crawl up together on a bush, all 1,000 to 3,000, and wait for an unsuspecting bird hunter or moose or deer to come by. and the moose don't realize when these ticks are on them. And so what happens is that you get all these ticks on them. They don't care what winter looks like. And by the time they've morphed into an adult winter tick in March and April, and they're feeding on the moose's blood, they can remove so much blood on a small animal that the animal can't replace that and causes an acute state of anemia and can lead to their death. So a couple of things about this project is we started this in 2014, the winter 2013-14, in cooperation with New Hampshire. We benefit from that because we share costs with our capture crew. We hire a professional outfit from the western United States. As you can imagine, catching a moose requires being in a helicopter and flying about 20 feet above that moose to shoot out a net gun to ensnare the moose. There's no drugs involved. The moose is on the ground. The two muggers jump out, grab the moose, wrangle it, put a blindfold on, put hobbles on its legs. That calms the animal. And in less than 10 minutes, if it's a calf, they have it weighed. Blood samples, fecal samples, hair, put a GPS collar on that animal and put ear tags in it. Cut it loose. First year we started this in western Maine. That's an important area for moose, as we know, because we all, as Mainers and those from outside of our state, love moose for a variety of reasons, culturally, aesthetically, ecologically, recreationally. We like to have moose on the landscape. And so we started this study by having 30 adult cows and 30 calves collared in our western unit. We continued that to this year where we added a northern study area to compare differences among our northern study area, which is District 2, which goes from Ashland, Route 11, all the way over to the Allagash and from the Reality Road to the northern border in Canada. So we have two study areas. We're trying to maintain every year a minimum of 35 adult cows over time, and then every year we got to put in 35 more calves. Surviving calves become part of the adult cohort and move on in this world. The big thing about this project is because they have GPS collars, if a moose dies, it sends me an email or a text, and me and my crew jump into our truck, and the next morning we're out there by truck, snow sled, and snowshoe to get to that animal to perform a necropsy of that moose, to collect tissues from literally head to hoof, and bring that back to the university for additional testing. We look at everything, nutrients, vitamin deficiencies. We do external tick loads, inside parasite loads. I know more about the inside of a moose than most people would want to know. But very, very, very comprehensive. And this year, Vermont joined the fray. So we have three northern states of New England all doing the same work, all collaborating, sharing data to try to understand the dynamic of adult cow and calf survival and really winter tick. So thank you.
Thank you. Yeah. Has Vermont collared both of their moose yet?
They used the same capture crew, and they were successful in putting out, I think basically a similar dynamic to us, 30 adult cows they started with and 30 calves. We're 35 and 35.
Questions? Representative Harlow?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I was just curious, do you do that same process on moose? If people call you to tell you that a moose has died in the woods, how do you decide whether you proceed with that or not?
Yeah, that's a great question, and it's the type of scenario that led to the survival study once we got the resources to be able to do that. So for decades now, both the Maine Warden Service and the biological staff have responded to dead moose in the woods, essentially. And if it's something that it's a complete carcass, let's just say, then we would try to take a look at it. And when we started this work, and I started my collaboration with the University of Maine Animal Health Lab to look at diagnostics, originally we were looking at moose and looking, especially in the springtime, if somebody saw a dead moose, we'd go and we'd look at tick loads, we'd open up the moose and look at internal parasites in the lungs. And, you know, we're starting to make some connections there. Young moose dying, heavy tick loads accompanied by parasites in the lungs. When we got the study up and running, we made it obviously more quantitative by having a sample of these animals in two different study areas so we can look at other variables that come into play and to not be relegated by just saying maybe it was Winter Tech, but being able to look at every possible thing. So we do this external exam. Is there anything obvious? Did it have a broken leg? You know, what was the circumstance? And then we obviously go inside and do a complete necropsy. So to date, we will respond depending on availability, where the animal is located. But the bottom line is we like to get that information and find out what town was that in, what was the sex of the animal, what was the age of the animal. And usually I ask people if you can pull a tooth, we'll get a more specific age on that.
Go right ahead, Representative Harlow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the reason I'm asking is because last spring, I think it was, or last March, I found a dead moose in the woods and not in Portland, actually. It was off the Bemis Track in Western Mountains. And so I called, I talked to somebody on this committee and said, should I call or not? And he said, yes. So I called, and the person didn't ask me any questions. So my question would be, where should we call?
Yeah, there's usually it would be trying to get in touch with a regional biologist, and there's two in each of the seven regions that we have, so the two biologists that are strong, or if you're able to get a hold of a district warden to let them know. You know, it's been a tough thing, a lot of folks working for the department and trying to figure out what the right call is, and even to date, we always ask that question because as things have changed, and with the project up and running, those things have changed a little bit over time.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Which tooth should Representative Harlow pull?
The canine.
Okay.
And it might surprise you to know that I did work after college at a store in Oquassic where we did tag moose and deer, so I have cut teeth. So, there.
Representative Reed and then Ellie.
Do you see this as a mild winter and going to be more severe in terms of ticks? Or how do you see this winter as it relates to?
Yeah, that's a great question. Because the life cycle of the winter tick is complicated because the fall weather makes a big difference. So now we're talking about what happens in October and November. So in other words, the conventional wisdom, and this is stuff that's really being worked on, is that if we get a typical Maine fall, windy, we need days where it's 32 degrees out. We need early snowfall to be on the ground to cover those larval ticks. That's a good thing. And then on the flip side of that, in the springtime, see the moose ticks don't care. The winter tick doesn't care what December, January, and February, and March look like. It could be no snow. It could be a lot of snow. They're on the back of the moose. They're in the moose's hair on the skin. They don't care about winter. They care about the fall. And then the adult females, once they have mated on the moose in March and April, they take their blood meal, fall off the moose, lay their eggs. Do they fall in snow or do they fall on bare ground? And the likelihood of their survival in bare ground is high, and in deep snow, they're probably going to die. Although it's interesting, I could talk about this all day, but I mean, you know, the heat that they have from the blood and metabolizing that, they fall through the snow column. So they can survive.
Huh.
But it depends on snow depth. So the answer to your question there is that it's unclear, and we're working on that currently in conjunction with our survival studies. So you have collared animals that you can track over time, and then over time you can look at all the environmental variables, whether that's first snow, temperatures, I don't know if we can do wind speed, to try to parse out what is it that drives winter tick populations. But the other part of this equation that is not completely understood is that obviously the number of animals on the landscape, the density of those animals, if you have a high density of animals in one spot, that'll increase the number of parasites. And so the question in Maine, looking back retrospectively, is that, you know, our population obviously came back in the 80s. And by the 90s, we had a slug of moose. And we had so many moose that likely there's some connection with winter tick having more moose, because moose is an easy target and they do well on moose, so that moose winter tick population grows as well. And so did we see those two climbing together? And then you start to lose some of those moose calves and your moose population becomes stagnant in some areas, decreases. And what does that all mean? And that's some of the things that we're trying to pull all together scientifically, quantitatively, so that we can answer this to figure out where we go next for management actions.
So that's pretty much what I was going to ask. about was you did say that they have a late moose hunt, and they take just cows. Ain't that kind of defeating our purpose if we have a bad winter or we have a lot of ticks that kill the moose when we take and kill the cows where all the little ones come from?
Yeah. So that's the challenge that we're going to face that's counterintuitive, which is winter tick and other parasites. When these moose are heavily infested with parasites, it implies that there's too many moose on that landscape. Now, whatever that number is, it doesn't matter. What matters is that the parasite loads are an indication that too many moose close together causing that problem. So when we had a lot more cow permits, so back from around 2009, 2010, 11, 12, that's high point was in 2013 where we had a lot of cow permits in there. I maintain that that was very necessary because on one hand, the level of permits that we've issued in cow permits has not necessarily been enough to drive that population down. So just because you harvest some cows doesn't mean it's enough of that population to drive that number down. Really, the drivers in our moose population are lower productivity. So what we've seen is that our adult cows are not producing the young that they did in the 80s. And one of the reasons we think is that the parasite loads on them have raised havoc on their nutritional status going into the spring before they calve. And so they're losing, whether they're losing the fetus or giving birth to low-weight calves that cannot survive those first 3 weeks. That is one hypothesis or scenario that's going on. The second thing is, when I fly next week and I count and say we have 50 calves for every 100 cows in this management area, that's before March and April when that number of 50 calves for 100 may be reduced to half of that or more, so that by the time these calves become a yearling in May, instead of having 50 calves per 100 cows survive, it's 25 or less. Now, this is in some areas, not the whole state. And I want to make it very clear that in the northern part of the state right now, northeastern part of the state, moose look very stable to me from doing our aerial surveys. In other parts of the state, like our western unit, we've had very high calf mortality in the 3 years of our study in that one unit. Now, does that one unit represent the rest of our state? No, it does not. Does it represent some parts of it? It does. And the media has gotten this wrong. So we see a lot of gloom and doom. But the dynamic in our grand old state of Maine is that there may be, and we saw this last year with our calf mortality in our northern versus our southern, our western unit, is that there was a 25% difference in our overwinter calf mortality. Is that real or not? And isn't that going to carry through the next 5 years? We obviously don't know, but there may be differences. So, did I answer your question?
You did. Thank you.
Okay.
Sir, when would a calf most likely not make it? It dropped in what months compared in the northern part of the state?
So all calves, and that's a great question, have two perilous times, which is the first 3 weeks of their life, and for a variety of reasons, and one of them may be linked to the condition of that adult cow and how much that calf weighs at birth. It's got to weigh about 35 pounds when it's born. And then the second period of time is this March and April. So the calf makes it through that first three weeks of summer, and survival rates increase greatly. So it gets into the summertime, into the fall, and it does real well until March and April, and the time of tick death comes. Now, how do we know this? We know this because, again, well, and I didn't say this to you, and I apologize earlier, but part of our survival study is our adult cows, come May, we follow them literally in the field. We go in the field, and based on our radio telemetry, GPS data, we know where these cows are, and we go and look to see if she's got a calf at heel. So of all of our collared animals, we can see, does she have a calf or not, and then does that calf stay with her and survive through the end of summer when her survival comes better? So the long and short of it is that those are the two tough times for calves.
Follow up.
Is there a period of time when the abundance of food in the streams and things that the young calf has to learn that's going to benefit this calf through the winter months? That's all I'm sure learned by following its mother in the streams and learning what to eat and what not to eat. Is that correct?
Yeah, absolutely. So you're talking about a moose being weaned because, of course, a calf is primarily on milk, colostrum when it's born. And then as the summer goes on, it starts to act like an adult moose. It actually develops an adult stomach. It's not born with all four chambers. And by August, it's weaned. It still has a bond with the mother and tries to nurse and will continue doing that into the fall, but it's weaned onto vegetation and normal moose foods by then. Yeah.
Representative Lyford, yep.
Thank you. Would you say that your toolbox in the research you're doing is half full, is full? In other words, I'm trying to determine if you have more things that you could do for this, or are you pretty comfortable with what you're doing?
It's a good question. We've been very, very fortunate in the last several years with our federal Pittman-Robertson funds and be able to get matching funds and things like that. And we've been able to do a lot. I think all biologists would say we'd always like to be able to do more. What that would look like, it's not clear. But, obviously the research and capturing and collaring moose and following moose is expensive. Helicopter time is expensive. We get quite a good break working within the state with our guys. But, it's a lot of money, and we can always do more.
If I could, you mentioned your staff. Are you staffed well? Are you lean? Well, we're going to have some bills come forward that want to fund this moose thing, and I'm wondering, do we need to do this, or are we comfortable?
I don't know. I defer to my many supervisors I have here on that one. But
okay. Let me change tone then, if you want me to. Coyote pressure, and I understand our bear population far exceeds the manageable amount. Bear bothering, coyote bothering, or not?
Bothering moose?
Yeah.
Look, from my perspective, I spent a lot of time in the field with the moose, and I have done a majority of the responses on necropsies, and, you know, coyotes are not a factor at all. And I know there'll be people who will challenge that, but we've seen no evidence of that in the field. Bears in other jurisdictions, they can predate on moose calves, and probably in just the first few weeks of life. In our state, we don't know to what extent. We don't have that quantified, and you really can't, that would be a difficult question and answer. We can say there's probably some impact somewhere, but we wouldn't be able to be definitive about that.
Representative Mason.
Yeah, I have a question. I read a bit about the winter tick, and it's very devastating, as you have told us. And I just wondered, is there any kind of research or development for some sort of preventive measure, because you're collaring them? Is there something you can do possibly at that same time to, as we've advanced with dog ticks, I know it's a whole different ball game, but I wondered if that had been researched at all.
Well, it's a great question, because we get a relative fair number of requests from the public about this type of thing. And I don't know from the veterinary perspective, you know, what they've done. And there's certainly preventatives out there, as we know, for dogs and cats and things like that. The problem becomes that if there was some sort of something you could put on a moose, the problem becomes with a wildlife population is that it's fine and good to save one animal, so to speak, but you need to affect a population. And, you know, for instance, with moose, it's to actually be able to reach out and grab X number of moose to make a difference is unbelievably, not only as a resource intended, I don't even think it could be done, honestly. And look, I've done 7 years flying in the helicopters, low-level flying, I've done some roadside darting of moose. It doesn't turn out to be a very practical way. You can't, you know, to somehow dose these animals. And as far as our research project, that would taint the research, because obviously with our research, we collar these calves, collar the cows, and we do nothing when we have them in hand, so to speak, as far as antibiotics or anything, because whatever happens, happens. And so last year, for instance, was our, when we send the crew out, the capture crew, they don't judge a moose, so to speak, and say that one looks kind of, something's wrong with it, we won't capture that one. And last year we had an adult cow that had a very bad wound under its shoulder, and that cow wound up being the first cow to die. And that was actually one of the only wounding losses that we've seen in 3 years. So that was from a fall bullet that we lost this moose. But we don't tell the capture team, yeah, don't capture that one, because it would bias the research. So we don't do anything on those moose to change what's going on at the time.
You've described to me before your surveys, your aerial surveys, and I was thinking they don't pay you enough. Can you describe for the committee what it's really like to fly a helicopter just over the treetops while surveying?
It's, I tell you, you know, I can see the commissioner looking at me right now. I got two little kids. I have no interest in thrills at all, believe me, at all. The classification of flights, the neat thing about being able to do this, and again, we would be nowhere without the Maine Forest Service. And I just say that because they are such team players, and they have the right equipment, and they have pilots who are extraordinary. And on Monday, Jeff Miller was our pilot. He lives in Bodenham. We had to leave Old Town at 7 a.m. to fly District 1, which is the most northwestern corner of the Maine, up above the St. John. So Jeff said, yeah, I'll come up and fly that. That survey requires you to be constant elevation at 200 feet above ground. We have a radar altimeter that's in the helicopter. We have two observers on the left side of the helicopter that have a 200-foot transect marked on their window. So we calibrate this by going to an airport, marking 200 feet on the ground. When I get up at 200 feet, I look at my skid, and I mark 200 feet on my bubble window out, so I know that's 200 feet. When we fly the survey, myself and Scott, who's one of our regional biologists who sits behind me, cannot hear or talk to each other. So we relay how many moose we're seeing to a third biologist who sits behind the pilot. So as we fly those transects, each one's 25 miles long, I see a moose, I say, one moose, top, running. So it's at the top of my transect. And Kendall, who's the recorder, we'll hear that, and at the same time, Scott's talking to him, and we'll say, two moose, top, and Kendall decides by what we said whether we're seeing the same moose or different moose. Now, our vantage points are a split second apart, so Scott can see two, and I didn't see one because it was out of my transect. And we do that seven times. Those are 25 miles long each, and we do that in a 100-square-mile block that represents the habitat, that represents the whole management unit. Now, that takes a day of flying. And believe me, when I was flying on Monday, my sixth line, I could barely keep it together. I was just the focus of the landscape's going by you at 45 knots, 200 feet above ground. You're trying to find a moose. And as big as they are, sometimes they like to hide in softwood cover. And the focus is you can't think about what you had for breakfast, because then you start to picture it, and you're not seeing a moose. The nice thing about the survey, because it's a statistical model, is that if I miss a moose or Scott misses a moose, the other person might or may not see it. And the statistics, the math works out that it creates an estimate by that model. It's a challenge for me to explain. And then the second survey is a separate survey where we're looking at bull cows and calves. And the nice thing about moose, unlike other critters like deer, is that even when the antlers drop, all female moose have a white vulva patch, even a female calf. A cow has a brown face, all uniform. A bull has a bicolor face, black on the muzzle going into brown. They have different bell shapes and sizes. They're not my guys, they're the commissioner's guys, but we're a pretty close crew. And to date, we've probably classified over 3,000 moose in our missions. We're pretty good at it, if I do say so myself. But the interesting thing is at 600 feet above ground, which is pretty darn close to the ground, you can see two moose and say, oh, that's a cow and a calf. You get down to 200 feet above ground and you see, oh, it's a young bull and a cow. So we've learned by doing this that, you know, you can't do it in a fixed wing. In the state of Maine, you can't do it. We tried, you can't do it. And they do that in western states, and God bless them. You'll never get me up there. You can pay me anything. I wouldn't do it. But we do it in a helicopter, and it's functioning real well.
God, if I were on that flight, my seat would not stay dry.
Well, anybody deserves extra pay besides me when I do that. My buddy Scott, who flies behind me, gets airsick regular, and he's learned to do hand signals with Kendall in the back when we're seeing bull cows and calves because, and I'm just saying this, he'd kill me if he knew this, but, you know, we were committed, you know, and commitment is Saturday night when you call up the pilot and he's on a date with his wife and you say, tomorrow it's five mile per hour winds, no precip, we want to go up and fly the Allegash. You in? I'm in. And it's Sunday morning.
So. Any other questions from the committee? Thank you very much.
Okay.